Welcome to New York, Quebec, and the water route to the center of the world. This is bonus episode one, Le Grand Derangement, the Acadian expulsion and the fall of Louisbourg. If one were to travel through the modern day U.S. state of Louisiana, you would quickly be transported to what seems like another world. French language signs adorn the streets as the sounds of Zydeco or Louisiana French folk music fills the air. Most would cite the menagerie of foods combining French peasant recipes with African and native additions, cooked into the various creatures inhabiting the bayou or swamps, as the most intriguing sight of all. The genesis of this unique culture started far to the north in what is now the modern Canadian maritime province of Nova Scotia, which was part of the French colony of New France and was historically referred to as Acadia. Acadia is a peninsula facing the Atlantic Ocean to the east and the Bay of Fundy to the west. Through an isthmus, the peninsula is connected to mainland Quebec. Interactions with the local native tribes of the Mi'kmaq peoples were mostly peaceful, due to the mutually beneficial fur trade and light settlement footprint as compared to the English colonies to the south. Acadian settlers gradually tamed the many salt marshes with a system of communal dikes and created fertile farming land. This food production acted as a breadbasket feeding French military fortifications to the north and in the more heavily populated St. Lawrence River Valley. Colonial wars would rock the province for almost the next 106 years due to the colony's geographic position and undefendable coastline. Constant English and even Dutch assaults placed the Acadian population underneath shifting sovereignties. In what would form a central argument for their later expulsion, the population was forced to sign ever-changing oaths of allegiance to both the British and French crowns depending on the victor. Intermarriage with the Mi'kmaq peoples placed them in further peril. The natives had, by the late 1600s, converted to Catholicism. They were engaged by Catholic priests serving as French royal agents in raids against the New England colonies to the south as part of the wider Algonquian-speaking Wabanaki Confederacy. The tipping point came in 1710, during the War of Spanish Succession. Determined to stop raiding once and for all, the British lay siege to and captured the primary Acadian town of Port Royal on the Bay of Fundy. The peninsula and islands to the north fell into British hands and the French-speaking populations fled inland. In 1713, the Treaty of Utrecht ended the war and left Acadia solely in the hands of the British Empire. The Northern Channel Islands, including Cape Breton, were returned to France. The treaty was vague on borders between the new British colony of Nova Scotia and New France. It stated the border as markers between the ancient lands, which was interpreted by the French as their intact colony, stretching from the St. Lawrence River Valley through the Great Lakes and down the Mississippi. Where this border met English land was from the isthmus between New Brunswick and Nova Scotia. This narrow area was heavily fortified by both sides. Each was determined to either trap the Acadian population or attract them to flee. The native peoples, including the Mi'kmaq, refused to recognize the treaty and, combined with displaced Acadian settlers, continued a low-level guerrilla conflict known as Father Rail's War, lasting from 1722 to 1727. Across the peninsula, the Mi'kmaq Confederates swooped down from New Brunswick and on to the frontier settlements of Maine, New Hampshire, and western Massachusetts. The raids resulted in several hundred dead New England colonists and depopulation of English inland settlers to the fortified coast, all over about a three-year period. In Nova Scotia itself, the city formerly called Port Royal was now renamed Annapolis. This was placed under siege in 1722 by a group of Mi'kmaq natives and Acadians. The British sallied forth and broke the siege. Amongst the prisoners, they discovered 86 New England hostages that had been spirited through the various tribes of the Wabanaki Confederacy, and thus revealing the extensive reach of the natives. Acadian willingness to join in the guerrilla war was precipitated by British demands requiring an oath to the British Crown in exchange for recognition of land titles. The oaths were a complicated and onerous burden on a heavily Catholic population, due to the British Crown also being the head of the Protestant Anglican Church. Many settlers faced land loss on one hand and a tax or banishment from intertwined native communities on the other. A low-level insurgency on the Acadian Peninsula would continue on and off until the French and Indian War almost 35 years later. Protestant settlement under crown rule in Nova Scotia or Acadia continued unabated, throughout the first half of the 18th century. Colonial surveyors were embedded in both Crown and local New England forces, giving British authorities a clear view of the landmass and population size, along with its distribution throughout Nova Scotia. British expansion ebbed and flowed at the rate of conflict that played out in and around Peninsula. King George's War, or the War of Austrian Succession, started in 1744, allowed the British to target both French fortifications on Cape Breton Island, protecting access to the St. Lawrence River, and Fort Beausejour, protecting the neck of land connecting Nova Scotia to New France proper. The war saw vicious fighting all the way from Maine to the New York frontier, including the sacking of Saratoga, New York. The Iroquois Nation attempted to counterattack New France from the upper Hudson Valley, but were forced to pull back when the bulk of Crown forces concentrated on capturing French fortified positions. The fortress at Louisbourg was the number one target in 1745. This large stronghold supported French claims to the peninsula and provided upriver protection for the capital of New France at Ville de Quebec. Americans and other Europeans also freely traded at the port and avoided imperial taxation systems. The fortress was surrounded and bombarded by counter-batteries, situated on undefended low-rises behind the stellar seaward defenses, as French naval relief forces floundered in destructive storms as they tried to cross the Atlantic. The victory at Louisbourg was more of a united New England victory than that of the Crown's regular forces. Massachusetts led the way with a large levy raised and passed by the legislature to fund the capture of the fort. New England raised over 4,000 troops and a flotilla of colonial vessels outfitted with arms. To their dismay, the fort of Louisbourg was returned to the French in exchange for Madras in India at the end of the conflict in 1748. The British were determined to secure Nova Scotia once and for all the following year. They would pursue a series of fortified towns and blockhouses covering the majority of the French population on the peninsula. In order to tie these fortified links together, Crown officials decided to build a new power base facing the Atlantic, and that would be easy to resupply by sea. In 1749, a large amount of transports and troops landed and started constructing what would be known as the modern city of Halifax. The low-level mixed insurgency of French and natives kicked into high gear, as the establishment Halifax was seen as a violation of previous treaties with the British. The fort at Louisbourg, and more importantly, the fort of Beausejour on the neck of land connecting to mainland New France, provided hubs for the resistance to British rule. The French crown sent priests into the Acadian population centers, who then acted as secret agents of the French king. These priests provided leadership and connections to supplies at the existing French forts. The British inflamed tensions, further demanding another pledge of loyalty to a Protestant king in response to the infiltrations by Catholic priests. Refusals abounded, and evictions of Catholic French families rose ever higher in a similar fashion to the tensions of the day. A priest by the name of Father Loutre led about 2,500 Acadian and native families north away from British rule and closer to French fortification. The abandoned land was itemized and made ready for settlement by Protestant from New England by 1750. Father Loutre would use this new pool of refugees to raid British targets through the start of the French and Indian War in 1754. The French and Indian War provided the Crown with another chance to finally crush French power at both Louisbourg, Fort Beausejour, and at Ville de Quebec. British authorities had fought six major wars against the Acadian French and their native allies in the last 75 years. In the eyes of the Crown, French settlers on the peninsula were just exacerbating the conflict by providing the French forts with supplies and men. The decision was made by the Governing Council in Nova Scotia to deport all French Acadians residents, regardless of their avowed loyalty. In 1755, the Fort Beausejour faced a siege led by 2,000 New England troops who had come to avenge the frontier massacres committed by Father Le Loutre and his band of refugee recruits. New England viewed Fort Beausejour as giving comfort and assistance to their most terrifying enemies. French positions in the fort were undermined by a British spy who worked as a clerk. After 1 month, a British shell penetrated the power room, and the resulting explosion caused the French garrison to surrender. Crown forces then turned their attention to the fortress at Louisbourg on Cape Breton Island. In 1758, French naval forces were defeated at Toulon in the south of France and prevented from reinforcing Louisbourg. The British brought 14,000 troops to bear on Fortress and commanded by the famous General Wolfe of later Quebec fame. French defensive forces consisted of around 4,000 army and marine troops. British naval forces destroyed much of the French naval presence and opened the way for Wolfe to direct an amphibious landing under the walls with cannon to start beating down the French fortifications. But it almost was a complete failure on June 8, 1758. Gabarus Bay was heavily fortified with a 20-foot-deep trench topped with abatis, similar in manner to those that had delivered victory at Carillon. 2,300 soldiers and 30 cannon covered the cove. High winds and bad seas forced Wolfe's men away from the fortifications and onto a rocky promontory. It just so happened that a small protected cove existed to shield the landing boats, along with a quick marching route that led directly behind the French entrenchments. The British fortified their position and landed their siege cannon. The siege lines were methodically moved in a diagonal fashion toward Louisbourg's walls, until they were a mere 200 yards away on July 25th. With incendiary mortar shells being lobbed point-blank into the town, the French, satisfied with their defense, asked for terms of surrender. British General Amherst denied them the honors of war and insisted all French combatants would become prisoners of war. The British cited massacres by French native allies as the reason to deny them the honors. Without any alternative, the French surrendered, with the British taking possession on July 26, 1758. British officials had earlier started their deportation campaign in 1755 by forcing leading Acadian civilians into tricking their compatriots to assemble for a town meeting. British troops were there to catalog and then march the residents to the coasts. Rural areas witnessed flying columns of British soldiers who flushed out and organized residents for deportation. By the end of 1755, 6,000 Acadians had been deported from the environments around Fort Beauséjour and the north of the peninsula. Almost all of these deportees were sent to the 13 colonies. Most gathered in colonial port cities until the Treaty of Paris in 1763. In 1758, more than 4,000 French settlers were deported when Louisbourg fell. These deportees were sent to Britain and France to await the end of the war. The French and Indian War continued for another 5 years beyond the fall of the fort at Louisbourg, and all the while Crown forces kept deporting the smattering of remaining French Acadians. The remaining Acadians were sent both to Europe and the Caribbean. Most historians place the number of French Acadians deported at around 13,000 souls. The end of the war saw a large movement of 2,000 to 3,000 French Acadians leave France and migrate to Spanish Louisiana. Louisiana was recently a French colony, but was given to the Spanish by the English as a reward for their participation in the Seven Years' War. Acadian settlers were prevented by Spanish authorities from settling with their French compatriots, but were instead scattered amongst the northern prairies of what is now the U.S. state of Louisiana. Eventually, the Acadians were allowed to move south into New Orleans and the surrounding bayous by 1770. They intermingled with African slaves, previous French settlers, and Spanish influences to create the modern Cajun culture. Garde le bon temps rouler, or Keep the Good Times Rolling, encapsulates the Acadian people's historical memory for sudden and life-altering change. Le Grand Derangement, or The Great Upheaval, as the event of the expulsions is known by, has contributed to the overall population of 200,000 fluent French speakers in the current state of Louisiana. Many hundreds of thousands more are proficient or moderate speakers throughout the state. Louisiana is the only U.S. state to have such high numbers of French speakers into our modern times, but speakership is dropping from a high of over 1 million in the 1960s. State efforts include language preservation through signage, university cultural departments, and membership in Francophone international organizations to build and preserve this unique culture. I wanted to add some more depth to our conversation and bring in some personal historiography I've compiled on Le Grand Derangement. Francis Parkman's thesis on the reasons behind the Acadian expulsion is the agents of the French court, civil, military, and ecclesiastical, had made some act of force a necessity. Francis argues that the French government constantly agitated the populace of Acadia to revolt. Le Loutre, a Catholic missionary priest along with his Indians, was acting as an agent of the French king by threatening and cajoling the Acadian people. The French settlers were told fidelity to King Louis was inseparable from fidelity to God, and that to swear allegiance to the British crown was eternal perdition. The French treated the Acadians as mere tools of policy, to be used, broken, and flung away. The French government cheated the Acadians out of large sums of money through corrupt agents. The Treaty of Utrecht, which he describes as by the newfangled construction of the treaty, which the French boundary commissioners had devised, more than half the Acadian peninsula, including nearly all the cultivated land and nearly all the population of French descent, was claimed as belonging to France, though England had held possession of it for more than 40 years. Since the treaty claimed France as the rightful owner of much of Acadia, it would be lawful for France to seize it by force. Parkman says the treaty, coupled with the fact that honor demanded of her, France, having incited the Acadians to disaffection, she should intervene to save them from the consequences. France's chances of successfully seizing Acadia were good, because at any time more troops could be sent from Louisbourg or Quebec, coupled with 4,000 militia and Indian fighters. The English, according to Parkman, could not withstand a direct attack because they had little troops and they were scattered far and wide. British officers feared a large French squadron of ships would appear any time in the Bay of Fundy, and this would cause the entire population to revolt against the British. He says the immediate military threat that was caused by the French side had forced the British to make the drastic decision to deport the Acadians. The Acadians were to be given one last chance to declare themselves loyal to the British and not stay in the neutral zone that previous oaths had allowed them to do. The oath that was offered to them required that the Acadians serve in the British army against the French. Deputies representing 9/10 of the population of Acadia were called before the British government in Halifax. They were told that the time was short because the French were at hand and could attack at any moment. They must either pledge their full loyalty to England or be sent away. They refused the oath, and the deportation was then started. He writes, "Whatever judgment may be passed on the cruel measure of the wholesale expatriation, it was not put in execution till every resource of patience and persuasion had been tried in vain. The British were disappointed because they hoped to substitute loyal English subjects in the place of the French. The Massachusetts soldiers that were offered the land chose not to stay in Acadia, but instead went home." This is proof, according to Parkman, that this goes far to show that a longing to become their heirs had, as has been alleged, any considerable part in the motives for their removal. He's referring to the New England soldiers coveting the land of the Acadians and wishing to steal it from them by force. More than 6,000 men, women, and children were exiled in 1755. Many, Parkman says, remained behind and continued guerrilla warfare against the English. The final destination for most was Louisiana, where they prospered, while others fled to the Channel Islands and Quebec. Francis Parkman ends his history of the expulsion by saying, "The government of Louis XV began with making the Acadians its tools and ended with making them its victims." The next work, Empire of Fortune, Crowns, Colonies, and Tribes in the 7 Years' War in America by Francis Jennings, the reasons behind the Acadian expulsion had switched sides with blame falling upon the British. Jennings says that due to the expanding energies of New England, coupled with Nova Scotia's Lieutenant Governor Charles Lawrence's determination to end guerrilla warfare through military conquest, led to the deportation. Lawrence and his council determined the Acadians had no right to their land until they took a full oath to the British crown. To make the opinion official, the Chief Justice of British Nova Scotia was made to issue a ruling to this effect. Jennings says that the decision to deport the Acadians was made by Governor Lawrence's council, men who were either New Englanders or who, without exception, had been saturated with that policy of New England's expansion for years. Lawrence had been given orders by the British Crown to prevent the Acadians from going over to the French, but no outright explicit order to deport them. Between the council and Lieutenant Governor, it was decided that the best way to do this was to deport the population. After the expulsion, the council even congratulated Lawrence and promoted him to full governor. Since the Acadians refused to take the oath demanded by the British, they were no longer entitled to their lands. With no lands, they could be deported without a problem. Concerning the deportation, he writes, "All in all, some 6,000 or 7,000 persons were exiled during the last 4 months of 1755, was one of the largest mass migrations of the era, and other exiles followed. The British lost many potential workers, and at much cost to their treasury." Jennings says, "The British destroyed their homes and all the improvements so laboriously made upon their lands. The British did indeed settle Acadia with New England settlers in 1760. Unlike Parkman, who says the New England men left because they did not want to settle there, Jennings notes that the settlement was delayed by the destruction of the dikes that held back the salt water. The ocean washed over the lands, and the British had to eventually summon some of the same Acadians that they had deported back to fix the problem. The Acadians' deportation was paid for mainly through the Acadians' own confiscated property, and they were not sent to Britain out of fear that much outrage would be expressed by British ministers having to provide funds for their care. The deportees were sent to the 13 colonies, to the amazement of governors in New York and throughout the South. They were not aware of the deportation or the plans to send the French settlers to their colonies. On the other hand, New England's colonial governments had advance notice. Frank Brecker's Losing a Continent, France's North American Policy, 1753 to 1763, written in 1998, builds upon earlier works by expanding the scope of the expulsion. Brecker expands the period of the expulsion from 1755 to 1758. The English followed up this 1755 deportation by additional ones of French Acadians from their traditional homelands and places of wartime refuge elsewhere in the region, Ile Royale, Ile Saint-Jean, the mainland coastal area along and north of the Bay of Fundy. Brecker states the second round of deportations occurred in 1758 when the English captured the French fortress town of Louisbourg, and this gave them control of the Channel Islands of Cape Breton and Saint-Jean. More than 5,000 Acadians were deported in 1758, and ironically, most were legitimate French royal subjects living on recognized French land. If one puts this number together with Brecker's stated number of people deported in 1755, which is around 9,000, then the number of Acadians expelled forcibly from the region stands around 15,000. The author clearly blames English authorities and London itself when he writes, "The level of authority behind the action was demonstrated when London itself finally sanctioned this long-standing proposal by Lawrence, and, after English victories later in the war, followed up the 1755 deportation by additional ones of French Acadians." Brecker is stating that London approved of the deportations because it let the second wave of deportations be carried out. Brecker gives the British government in London the benefit of the doubt for the first deportation in 1755. But by their approval of the events in 1758, their guilt is clear. He writes, "If one could give the benefit of the doubt to the government of England regarding responsibility for the 1755 deportation, which it had approved only hesitantly and nearly after the fact, this benefit cannot be extended to those of 1758 and later, when the Acadians were forced to leave the region clearly as a result of formal government policy and despite the absence of security concerns." Brecker says that there was never any serious military threat that could be mounted by France because they could neither muster the naval nor land forces to invade Acadia. Most importantly, Brecher refers to the entire event as an act of ethnic cleansing. In William Nestor's book, The Great Frontier War, Britain, France, and the Imperial Struggle for North America, 1607 to 1755, written in 2000, support Brecher's claims on the expulsion. Nestor agrees with Brecker's figures, and he writes, "Between 1755 and 1762, 11,000 to 15,000 Acadians were expelled." Nestor expands on Brecker's timeline by extending the period of deportation to 1762. He too clearly blames the British authorities, and more specifically, Governor Lawrence. On July 18, 1755, he, Lawrence, expressed to the Board of Trade his determination to bring the inhabitants to compliance or rid the province of such perfidious subjects. The legality of the decision was upheld when the Nova Scotia Chief Justice rendered an opinion on the question of loyalty and property. The justice ruled that no Acadian had a right to the land he tilled unless he unconditionally declared himself a British subject. Nestor states Lawrence would not allow the Acadians to flee to Canada or other French territories for fear they would simply aid France's military efforts. This, of course, has been proven to be a falsehood because the Acadians who did flee in 1755 fled to the other territories, but gave no extra help in 1758 when the British seized Louisbourg. Military necessity is again proven false as a valid reason for the Acadian expulsion. The next historian to review the issue of the Acadians was Fred Anderson. He wrote a book entitled Crucible of War, The 7 Years' War, and the Fate of Empire in British North America, 1754 to 1760. Anderson published his book in 2000 and follows up Brecker by writing The Entire Scheme, So Chilly Reminiscent of Modern Ethnic Cleansing Operations, was executed with a coldness and calculation, and indeed an efficiency rarely seen in other wartime operations. Anderson feels that the event is of such magnitude that it deserves to be described in this manner. Anderson says that with the conquest of Acadia, the New England troops had only one task remaining: to disarm, detain, and deport the indigenous Acadians. This extraordinary move, perhaps the first time in modern history, a civilian population was forcibly removed as a security risk. This is quite a different tone used to describe the event, and it even goes beyond Brecker's statements. Anderson is saying this is the first time in modern history that a deportation of a people for military reasons has occurred. It really leaves the English side seeking firm reasons to justify their actions. Anderson truly singles out Massachusetts Governor William Shirley as the architect of the deportation. He said Shirley had practical reasons for promoting the campaign because it would increase his control of the government of his state by flooding the patronage system with opportunities to gain prestige and money. Also, he knew that colonists would be interested in the new land that would be opened up to them once the Acadians were gone. Anderson writes, "There were strong indications that William Shirley himself was the architect of the deportation, and that his real intention was to neutralize any Acadian military threat in order to make the farms of the Acadians available to recolonization by New Englanders and other Protestants." He says that even before the New England troops returned home, Protestant settlers had moved in. By 1763, there were no fewer than 5,000 New England fishermen and farmers living on Acadian land. Anderson gives credit to the number of Acadians deported in 1755 as around 5,400, and says another 7,000 to 10,000 fled north to Louisbourg and the Channel Islands. These Acadians would be caught up in the second wave of deportations starting in 1758. The total number of people deported approaches 15,000 souls, according to Anderson. A mere 5 years later, in William Fowler's Empires at War, The French and Indian War and the Struggle for North America, 1754 to 1763, New England and William Shirley are still clearly at blame for the deportation. Fowler writes, "For decades, the English, particularly New England land speculators, had coveted the fertile Acadian lands along the Bay of Fundy and the Minas Basin. The trouble of the 1750s provided them with an opportunity to seize by force what they had been unable to take by persuasion and purchase." Fowler, like previous modern historians, continues to put emphasis on the desire of New Englanders to control the excellent farmland that abounded in Acadia. He is also implicating that the invasion of Acadia and the deportation of the inhabitants was mainly due to the desire on the part of the English to incorporate the lands for their own benefit. The French and Indian War provided the excuse for the actions of the English in 1755 and beyond. Jonathan Belcher, a close friend of William Shirley and Nova Scotia Chief Justice who rendered the opinion sanctioning the deportation, wrote, "The growing Anglo-French rupture provided such a juncture as the present that may never occur again." The Chief Justice was born in Boston and learned his skills as a protege of Shirley. Fowler indicates that this connection should cement the fact that Shirley was of the same opinion as the Chief Justice concerning the opportunity presented by the war. The progression of historians' views on the topic of the deportation of the Acadian settlers, starting in 1755, culminates with A Great and Noble Scheme, the tragic story of the expulsion of the French Acadians from their American homeland, by John Farragher. The work written in 2005 is the first book mentioned in this study of the historiography on the Acadian deportation, written exclusively on the topic itself. This is one of the most important changes over time in viewing the event because historians have afforded the topic enough importance to warrant writing an entire book on the subject. The other works previously mentioned contain the information on the deportation within the greater context of the French and Indian War. Farragher states in his introduction that the British government and previous generations of historians had defended the expulsion as a cruel necessity during wartime. In his opinion, the events of 1755 bear a striking similarity to more recent episodes of ethnic cleansing, the purposeful campaign of one ethnic or religious group to remove, by violent and terror-inspiring means, the civilian population of another ethnic or religious group from a certain geographic area. He goes on to state that the expulsion was executed methodically by British officers representing the government in London and keeping very strictly to a well-developed plan that was many years in the making. The planners used all available means and resources of the English state to carry out the act. It also bore the hallmarks of modern incidents of ethnic cleansing through the particular attempts to wipe out all previous memory of the Acadians through the destruction of Acadian records, archives, detainment and isolation of community leaders, and the separation of families. Farragher provides further insight into the planning and preparation of the deportation. He states that Governor Shirley of Massachusetts served on the Anglo-French Committee trying to solve the boundary problems caused by the Treaty of Aix-la-Chapelle, which recognized British claims to Nova Scotia. Shirley was considered such an embarrassment to the English government due to his hardline position on French intentions to resume the conflict that he was recalled. Shirley returned to his home state and immediately began to put in motion his large patronage machine by advocating British military action in Acadia. War had increased his political capital, writes Shirley's biographer. The discontinuance of war threatened to reduce it. He had motives to avoid peace. Farragher, says Shirley, then made contact with Lieutenant Governor Lawrence, whom Shirley wrote, "From the experience he hath had of the behavior and spirit of the Acadians," Lawrence responded with his own letter, "I flatter myself, as I could, with Mr. Shirley's assistance, raise a body of men in New England which, joined to the few troops we could muster, would, I believe, make a pretty successful campaign. The French inhabitants on that side must either be removed or driven totally away by fire and sword." Shirley introduced Lawrence to a plan written up by the provincial surveyor general Charles Morris, whom Shirley himself had appointed in 1749 in anticipation of settlement of Protestant immigrants. Morris argued in 1751 in a report he prepared for Shirley's work as boundary commissioner that, "As long as the Acadians possessed the chief granary of the country and all the water communication, it would be impossible to settle Protestants in the province without the removal of the Acadians." Morris argued not explicitly for the removal of the Acadians, but only studied the necessary steps one would take if this was ever to be undertaken. He argued that any steps to rid the province had to be kept secret, and that the best method would be for them to voluntarily walk into a trap set as a fake meeting of sorts. Farragher says that none of the orders issued during this period by the British appeared in the official records of the provinces. There is also a large gap concerning the deportation in public archives as well. Lawrence then follows Farragher's definition of ethnic cleansing when he summons community leaders away from their people to sign an oath he knew they would most likely refuse. When they refused, he imprisoned them. He then followed Morris's advice and summoned the rest of the populace to their town meeting places, arresting and dividing up families. The Acadians were fooled because they were kept in the dark by the seizure of their leaders. Farragher says the Acadians' wealth was seized and used to pay for their deportation. More than 7,000 Acadians were removed in the last months of 1755. In 1758, more than 3,000 Acadian civilians were deported, along with the entire French garrison of Louisbourg and colonial government officials. After the removal, Farragher writes that if removal was Lawrence's first objective, it would immediately be followed by the grant of the Acadian farms to soldiers and settlers from New England. By 1759, the new system of New England land ownership was in place, and more than 2,500 Protestant families lived in 9 townships. Farragher says to further justify the deportation, the newly formed Nova Scotia Assembly passed a series of laws. These laws provided a procedure pertaining to the granting of land to Protestant settlers. It also stated that the Acadians never lawfully possessed titles to their land. Catholics were banned from owning lands, voting, or holding office. It also said that any land still held by Catholics would be seized immediately. The Church of England was then given official status in the province. I hope you were able to see the progression of historians' view on the expulsion over time, and thanks so much for listening to New York, Quebec, and the water route to the center of the world.